You're listening to the FQXI podcast. Today,
he logged onto his computer, and the story I heard is he suddenly yelled out, "My God!" And his wife and son thought he was, you know, having a heart attack or something.
We reveal the biggest physics breakthroughs of 2016 as our end-of-year countdown, as chosen by physicist Ian Durham, concludes.
What's also interesting about this result, this being in my top five, there are actually multiple teams that were racing to this result, and several of them reached this result this year in using different methods.
I'm Zia Morali. Welcome to the Foundational Questions Institute podcast. This is the second and last part of our end-of-year rundown, in which we're counting down the biggest physics stories of 2016. If you haven't heard the first part yet, then you can listen to it on our podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast. In the last edition, quantum physicist and FQXI member Ian Durham of St. Onsen College in New Hampshire named the research highlight that came in at number 5 on his list, the first production of quantum knots. So now, we turn to the advance that came in at number 4.
There is an old problem that has always intrigued me, known as the Kepler conjecture, after Johannes Kepler. So this goes back over 400 years. Kepler had made this conjecture about the densest way to pack together equal-sized spheres in a given space. I wouldn't be surprised if Kepler got this idea from cannonballs on a ship. If you've got a bunch of cannonballs, how can you put them together most densely? He conjectured that the way to do it is that, just like they do it on ships, or did it on ships when they had cannonballs, is they do them in a pyramidal shape, right? So if you had 4 cannonballs, then you'd rest the next one in the notch between the 4, right? And you'd build that up into a pyramid. And so Kepler conjectured that the densest way to pack together these equal-sized spheres in a space is pyramidal. Now, it seems simple, but it actually wasn't proven fully until 1998 by a guy named Thomas Hales, who's now at the University of Pittsburgh. And it not only took until 1998 to prove this, but Hales' proof was 250 pages long. That was not just mathematical arguments, but it was combined with some mammoth computer calculations. And in an unprecedented move, when the journal finally released this and the reviewers signed off on it, they included a little caveat that said that the journal and the referees and the editors were 99% sure it was right, but they weren't absolutely positive because no one could really verify it. So then Hales actually started something called the Flyspeck Project, I think that's what it was called, to verify his own proof. Anyway, it has been accepted that his proof is true. So it has been assumed that the three-dimensional case of Kepler's conjecture has been proven. And in fact, it has been proven in several other dimensions. It's been proven in one dimension, and I believe in two dimensions as well. Well, this year, it was proven in 8 dimensions, and 24, in fact. So these two sort of obscure papers were posted online by a Ukrainian mathematician. The woman's name is Marina Vyazovska. She's actually a postdoctoral researcher in Berlin at the Humboldt University.
You know, you sent me this one, and I was reading through it, and the note that I made was, sounds very cute, why should we care? And that is because, you know, I was reading it, and I was thinking, yeah, I know that you are kind of a mathematician, and it does seem like something that mathematicians would be really interested in. But, you know, as you sort of described it, you know, somebody proved this for, you know, our normal world, with cannonballs or oranges or whatever you want to pile up in a pyramid shape. But why you would want to go and think about it in 8 dimensions or 24 dimensions seems just something that's obviously of very much interest to pure mathematicians, but not sure why it would be of interest to the rest of us. And
one of the things that mathematicians like to do is generalize and generalize and generalize, right? So well, if we prove something like how to properly stack cannonballs, you know, that's three dimensions. Why not prove it in every dimension, right? Is it going to have any practical importance? I have no idea. Well, in this case, it might have. What was interesting and what jumped out at me about this was that she found that there's a relation between this eight-dimensional case and there's this symmetric sphere packing in eight dimensions called E8. And anyone who follows FQXI will know of Garrett Lisi and his E8 theory of, it's kind of a theory of everything sort of thing. And so, in fact, there is a relation. And so I actually asked Garrett about this just because I was curious. I said, well, what, you know, how does this, how significant is this to your E8 theory? So Garrett's response was that the new result, he said, it's a little bit similar to the Higgs mechanism in physics in the terms of its significance. The 24-dimensional one is called the Leech lattice, so it's E8 and the Leech lattice. It had long been suspected by mathematicians that these were perfect sphere packings, but now this is an absolute proof. And so that is good because it gives more support for something like Garrett's theory, which is a physics theory, which relies on the E8 lattice. It doesn't necessarily say that Garrett's theory is right, but it means that the math on which Garrett is basing his theory has a stronger foundation.
So just in case any of our listeners are, you know, no more interested in possible theories of everything than they are in pure mathematics. Although I guess if listeners to our podcast aren't interested in that, I don't know why they're listening to our podcast.
I know.
But just in case. So in this, an article about this result by Erica Clarick in Quantum Magazine, she has given another very much more practical sort of application to this. I don't know if you know more about this. I don't quite understand what's going on here, but she explains that higher dimensional sphere packings are, you know, the mathematics behind them is sort of related to error correcting codes used by cell phones, space probes, and the internet to send signals through noisy channels. I don't know if you know about the maths behind that, and so that's something you want to talk about, or whether we can just leave that there as another reason why this kind of higher dimensional maths is interesting.
So I'm a little embarrassed to say this, because I should know about that since I'm a quantum information guy, but I don't do a whole lot with error correcting codes. So yeah, that's interesting. I'll have to look into that.
Yeah, we can just set it as a homework problem for listeners.
There you go. Homework problem.
Go and look into that and find out more about it for yourself.
There'll be a test.
Right, so I don't know whether to kind of hint a little bit at number three, but it's sort of interesting that with number four, you were talking about this problem that was identified or considered or conjectured by Kepler, which I didn't realize, you know, that was something that he was particularly looking into, because we kind of know of Kepler much more in sort of, I guess, astronomy terms and thinking about things like that, which is a not very subtle way to kind of lead you to number three on your list.
That's an impressive transition right there. I'm very impressed with that.
It was a bit hard work there, but...
Yeah. So number three on my list, of course, is switching gears entirely. And number three on my list is the discovery of Proxima Centauri b, which is an exoplanet that is orbiting within the habitable zone of the red dwarf star Proxima Centauri, which is the closest star to the sun. It's only 4.24 light years away. It's the closest star. If we were going to flee Earth at some point, you know, in 5 billion years when the sun blows up or blows into a gas giant, about the only place that we could reasonably go, I suppose, would be Proxima Centauri. And lo and behold, there's a planet there, and it is within the habitable zone. Now, there is a caveat to this. The caveat is that there have been some studies on what it's like around red dwarf stars, and the solar winds are likely extraordinarily high, more than 2,000 times those experienced by Earth, and it's entirely likely that that kind of radiation and wind would blow away any atmosphere, in which case the only really vaguely habitable place on the planet would be like underground somewhere. But nevertheless, that's an open question. We don't know. It's entirely possible there are habitable zones on it. We just don't know. But the point is that it's the closest exoplanet that'll ever be found to us, or the closest exoplanet system that'll ever be found to us, because it's the closest star, and it's in the habitable zone, which is just cool.
Was there something that came out recently about this?
In October, there were some French researchers did announce that there was a good chance that the planet harbored surface oceans and had a thin atmosphere. But it would be very hard to confirm those results, it's really just conjecture at this point, unless the planet were to transit in front of its star from our perspective, where we might be able to make out some atmosphere in the outline. And that's pretty impressive, by the way. The Proxima B was discovered in August, and by October, a bunch of people had already taken a look at it and determined that its mass would be about 1.3 times that of Earth, and it orbits about a tenth of the distance of Mercury from the Sun. But you have to remember that its star is also a red dwarf, so it's a much smaller star, so it's closer. So it's exactly at the right distance. And in fact, prior to this discovery, the Starshot project, which is funded by Yuri Milner, was aiming to send these sort of micro probes to that system just to say we did it. At 20% the speed of light, I think these probes were going to take something like 20 years to get there.
Yeah.
And then, of course, sending back a signal based on what they'd found, it would take another 4 years to get for the signal to get back here.
So you mentioned this breakthrough Starshot project, and I interviewed Yuri Milner about this a few months ago, back in May, after he announced it. So I guess after he initially announced it, it got kind of a mixed reaction from people. And this was sort of the point that I came in and was talking to him about it, because it had been criticized quite a bit, and a lot of people had kind of jumped in and said, you know, these are the 500 different ways that it could go wrong, which I suppose is not surprising since, you know, he's talking about sending tiny little probes off into space and hoping that they'll get there and, you know, intact and be able to carry out these measurements. And so, you know, I'll put up a link to this Q&A where he goes through some of the sort of technical obstacles that people have sort of discovered for this project and that he had to answer. But one of the questions that I asked him, you'd sort of touched on this, you talked about how, you know, in itself that's going to be a long project. You know, it might not start off for another 20 years and then it'll take 20 years to get out there and then we'll have to get, you know, results back. And you know, you're talking about maybe going to there many, 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 many hundreds of years into the future. And so I sort of asked him about, you know, whether he was worried about being able to sustain interest in this project over so many years. And he sort of gave this nice answer, which was that, well, you know, in the past, it's taken 200 or 300 years for people to come together and build cathedrals, but they still managed to do it. And so, you know, why couldn't people invest time over generations for a scientific project? Which I thought was sort of a sweet answer there.
I think that's a nice answer. And the other way I look at it, too, is I look at the Voyager missions. And the Voyager missions were launched in 1977. I was 3 years old. I'm now balding, gray-haired, middle-aged with two teenagers. You know, the Voyager projects are still going. And actually, if he could really do it in 20 years, and then, you know, from launch to arrival, and then it's about 4.24 years for the signal to get back. That's 25 years. That's actually not that long.
Okay, so, you know, sort of an optimistic, futuristic, optimistic story there.
Yeah.
Coming in at number three. What about number two?
Number two is the beating of the Rayleigh limit this year. So I'll have to explain what that is. The best way to understand it is, if you imagine yourself standing in a desert, someplace that's fairly flat and it has roads in it, and you imagine a car way on the other side coming towards you, and it's at night and the headlights are on, At some point, those two headlights are going to eventually resolve themselves into two, but when they're very far away, it's going to look like one light, right? This is actually a problem that has confounded astronomers for a very long time. How far apart, in terms of angular distance, do two light sources have to be in order for you to recognize them as being two light sources? And there was a fundamental limit that Lord Rayleigh had suggested existed. So it's the minimal resolvable detail. And it turned out that some of this was thought to be based on quantum mechanics. Well, this year they found a way to beat that limit. That's a true way to beat that limit. So these guys were able to find a different way of resolving these things so that it isn't a fundamental curse. There's a physical way of getting around it. What's also interesting about this result, and this being in my top five, there are actually multiple teams that were racing to this result, and several of them reached this result this year in using different methods. So in particular, there was a group that included some folks from the Czech Republic and from Spain, from Madrid, and basically it's a little bit like error correction. They were able to work out some optimal strategies to process the data coming in such that it was able to take out some of that error, the bleeding that comes from the, you know, the point source spreading out. And they were able to withdraw that and be able to determine that there were two point sources when previously there was only one. And they actually did an experimental realization of this. Simultaneously, there were actually several other groups. There's a group led by Ephraim Steinberg in Toronto that has a, and I'm not even sure Ephraim's published his work yet. He's got a slightly different way of doing it. And there was another group, Tsang, Nair, and Liu of National University of Singapore, did it in an entirely different way using quantum metrology. So there are at least three of these groups that came to the same realization this year and were able to beat that limit.
Do we have a sense of what sort of things we might be able to see now that this limit has been beaten? I mean, you know, you talk about kind of separating the light from two stars, but I guess do we have a sense of what that limit has prevented us from doing so far that maybe now we have a hope of being able to do when it comes to astronomy?
The classic example would be looking for exoplanets, right? So this might tie into the last one. It's very hard to actually physically see an exoplanet around another star because they're tiny and they're very close to these massive stars, you know. So you just imagine, you know, it takes 100 Earths to cross the face of the sun, right? You know, so some of that, not all of it, but some of that could be partly due to the Rayleigh limit. And so the Rayleigh limit could certainly help us in that regard. Being able to beat the Rayleigh limit could help us in that regard. You know, I still think there's probably going to be a fundamental limit. I don't think anyone's worked out exactly what that limit will be. It's just that the Rayleigh limit is no longer the limit.
You know, you mentioned this this term, this quantum metrology, and I'm reading this Physics Viewpoint by Gabriel Durkin of the Berkeley Quantum Information and Computation Center, mm-hmm. Berkeley. And, you know, he's talking about one of the studies that you were mentioning. And somewhere down the bottom here, he has this line that says, you know, a second detail worth pondering. And so since he said that it's worth pondering, I guess we should ponder it.
Okay.
Is that this result utilized techniques from the quantum domain to reveal a classical result. All of the physical assumptions about starlight admit a classical model. So I wonder, is that something worth pondering? The fact that, you know, we're looking at a sort of a classical thing and we're using somehow some kind of quantum, I don't know, wizardry to help us kind of look at this in some kind of more detailed way.
So it's not wizardry, it's just quantum mechanics. and the universe is quantum mechanical. Classical physics is emergent from the underlying quantum physics. I don't think that's a terribly controversial statement, although perhaps thinking about some of our FQXI colleagues, there might be a few who might take issue with that. But I think quantum mechanics is it is ultimately the fundamental. And so I don't think that this is all that unusual. I think it's great. I think more of this will likely be happening. Because if you stop and think about it this way, accuracy appears to be we have to make things more and more fine-grained, right? We have to look at things more and more closely. And when you do that, you're going to inevitably get into the quantum domain because you're going to get into the world of atoms and particles and things like that, and waves. And so I think there is no question that quantum metrology could perhaps make a big difference in a lot of classical situations, not even just quantum metrology, quantum mechanics in general. And in fact, I'll do the Sieg this time because I'm going to say that that is actually exactly what number one is about.
Okay, so here we go. Number one.
Number one is no surprise. It's LIGO, the discovery of gravitational waves, which is a huge, huge story. It's something that was predicted by Einstein's theory of relativity 100 years ago. It's going to win the Nobel Prize. I guarantee it. I'm not worried about being wrong on that one. It will win the Nobel Prize. I thought it would be this year. Maybe it was a little bit late for the nominations. Maybe it'll be next year. I can't imagine that it won't. Now, what is it and what is it discovering? So what we were looking for was gravitational waves, which if you think of space and time as a manifold, which is a debatable point, but if you think of it that way, these would be like ripples in space and time. They had been predicted by Einstein's general relativity, but had never been seen. And LIGO, what is just phenomenal about LIGO, is that the engineering that went into this, it's an incredibly simple concept, but the engineering that went into it was off the charts amazing. In addition, it was a very long-term project that the U.S. government invested in. It's amazing in this day and age that such a long-term investment was made, even when they first started this back in the '80s and the '90s. I'm not sure you would ever get anything like this funded again. It was amazing it got funded in the first place because they knew that it wouldn't likely yield results for 15 to 20 years. What they proposed was to build these LIGO detectors, which I'll explain in a minute. And they proposed that these LIGO detectors, that the first incarnation of them, would not produce any information. But they would use the 10 or 15 years that they ended up running them for, I think, 15 years of them running to tweak the system and just learn where they needed to make improvements. And as soon as they turned on the improvements, like virtually instantly, they got results. In fact, so there were sort of three guys who were really, if anybody's going to win the Nobel Prize, it's going to be these three guys. It would be Kip Thorne, and a lot of people know Kip Thorne from being the brain behind the movie Interstellar, and also being the guy who really brought study of wormholes to the forefront. And also, if you're... maybe you have his book, Misner, Thorne, and Wheeler. He wrote that giant book on gravity with John Wheeler and Charles Misner. So Kip Thorne, Ron Drever. Drever is a big name in lasers. There are several effects named after Ron Drever. And then Rainer Weiss. And there's a funny story about Rainer Weiss and the LIGO discovery. So I live in Maine. I live about an hour and a half north of Boston. And Weiss is at the MIT. And I think he owns a house up here on the Maine coast. He was either renting or he owns this house. But he was up here vacationing with his wife and I think his son here in Maine when he logged onto his computer. Now, Rainer is, I think he's maybe my parents' age, something like that. So he's not old, but he's not like 20. Let's just put it that way. And he logged onto his computer, and the story I heard is he suddenly yelled out, "My God!" And his wife and son thought he was, having a heart attack or something. So they run into the room, No, it was he had just gotten an email from this guy in Berlin, one of the, tech guys who had been up all night monitoring the results from the new LIGO when they had turned it on, and boom, there the results were. They had found the first gravitational waves. So that's LIGO in a nutshell.
And so, can you tell us more about how the LIGO experiment works?
So this is really pretty amazing. It's simply an interferometer. In other words, they have a beam of light, they have a laser, they pass that laser through a beam splitter, and it goes in two directions. And so it splits the beam into two pieces, and one beam goes off one way, and the other beam goes off another way. They call these arms. And so if you ever look at a picture of the LIGO facilities, there are two of them, one in Washington and one in New Orleans, Washington State, and one in down near New Orleans. Or, well, no, it's north of New Orleans, but in Louisiana. It looks like an L, kind of, very big L. The laser goes down each arm and then comes back, and actually it bounces around a little bit inside the arm. But then eventually the two beams come back and they reconnect. Now, they tune it so that essentially they reconnect in such a way that there's an interference pattern, a natural interference pattern that occurs when you bring two bits of light together. And now, the amazing thing about quantum mechanics and how these things work is just the slightest bit of change to either one of those waves can change the interference pattern that you get back at the beginning. So if you have it set up so that there's no light, so it's perfectly destructive interference back at the beginning, and then suddenly you start seeing photons, then you know something happened. And you know that one of the arms, in fact, what you know that one of the arms must be slightly longer than the other arm.
So then the idea is that if a gravitational wave passes through the apparatus, it will slightly change the size of one of the arms by a small amount, and that will create a noticeable change in the interference pattern when light from both arms is recombined, because now the light travelling through each arm has travelled a different distance.
And I mean slightly longer by a teensy little bit. I mean a teensy, teensy little bit. And that was the engineering feat behind this. This is incredible, incredible piece of engineering. So these arms, first of all, they're very long, 2 kilometers long, each arm. And that was in addition to the fact both arms were the greatest vacuum ever created by humans on Earth. They sucked out almost everything. Because any stray particle in there could cause the light to give you an interference pattern. We're talking about extraordinary precision. The reason that it's so long is that the longer it is, it gives you a better chance of testing a very, very small change, right? And the small change we're talking about here is like, what was it, 1/1000th the width of a proton or something? I mean, some insanely small value. So they built these long arms, and the arms are so long that they have to account for the curvature of the Earth. Let's say it starts up right on the ground, right? As it goes out, the Earth curves under it, so they have to start putting like stacks of things under it to keep it flat. And one of the problems they had to do is they had to find a way to not have false readings, right? So there are a couple of ways to do this. So for example, in the testing stages, they would have guys go out with motorcycles and drive next to the tube, right, to try and throw it off. And there were like three people who were all secret who had the ability to put false readings into the system, and they weren't supposed to tell anyone who they were, so no one was supposed to know who they were. And no one and they weren't supposed to talk to each other, and they would occasionally just throw in a false reading, and that was another way of making sure that they could detect these false readings. The reason they had two observatories was also if you saw a blip in one and you didn't see it in the other one, then it must have been something localized, like an earthquake or a motorcycle or something like that. So that is what LIGO did. And so when they discover gravitational waves, it's very simple. You see an interference pattern that you weren't expecting. And that's it.
So I think the thing that I loved most about that story was the idea about these kind of secret saboteurs who one day are just given the mission to inject false signals, and they can't tell anyone and they can't talk to anybody else about it. But it would be such a great job to have, although I don't know how you could kind of resist the urge to tell people.
I know, I'm impressed. I want to say Rainer Weiss was one of them. I can't remember exactly. It was pretty funny. Again, the amazing thing about this is we were talking about quantum metrology earlier. This essentially is quantum metrology. We've got a quantum system that is making a measurement at an exquisite, exquisite level. So the reason it's number one on our list is because it's confirmation at long last of a physics prediction. But what is so amazing about the LIGO experiment is that it is the engineering feat that it is, because it's very simple. You could even do this experiment in your basement. If you had a partially silvered mirror, you could do an experiment like this in your basement. You won't get the accuracy that you get with LIGO. And that's what's amazing about it. The accuracy is just incredible.
So they've done this. They found gravitational waves, which, you know, had been predicted to exist for 100 years. And they found them, these gravitational waves that were generated from the merger of black holes. And this is this kind of wonderful confirmation of a result that comes from general relativity. But having done that, they haven't just kind of, you know, shut up shop and said, okay, we did it. We confirmed general relativity. You know, they're still going. They're increasing the sensitivity of their detectors. And now I'm reading from an article in New Scientist by Lisa Grossman, who says that given that they already sort of saw two strong events in just 3 months, they're expecting to see at least six in the first half of next year, possibly more. And they're going to be upgrading the detectors, as I mentioned, so they're going to be 15 to 20% more sensitive. The Virgo detector in Italy is going to start taking data in March 2017.
And they built a spare that they never put anywhere, and they just gave it to India.
Oh, lovely, lovely.
So there's going to be another one in India.
And so, you know, what can they do with this now? You know, they're looking for gravitational waves. What can this, you know, tell us? We know they exist now, but what else can we do? What else can we learn?
It's an entirely different way of looking at the universe. Astronomers are absolutely excited about this because, you know, traditionally, our only way of observing the universe, even when we're looking at gravitational things, we're really looking at anything outside our planet. We're looking via electromagnetism, right? We're looking at light signatures. And so everything we see is via electromagnetism. This gives us an entirely different way of observing the universe. So the entire electromagnetic spectrum, there should be a corresponding gravitational wave spectrum. And just think of all of the other things that might be out there that maybe just might be too dark to give off any actual electromagnetic radiation, but they do give off some gravitational radiation. A lot of astronomers are actually giddy about this.
I don't know if you saw this, but there's sort of a controversial kind of interesting paper that came out a few weeks ago by Niyash Afshoordi. And he's looking into the idea of testing general relativity. We've said that the gravitational wave results is sort of a beautiful confirmation of general relativity.
Yes.
But some physicists had suggested that you could use these gravitational waves to test for the breakdown of general relativity or to look for quantum gravity effects. But, you know, it was just kind of exciting that, you know, already people are looking at ways to look for deviations from general relativity. And we don't have very much data yet from LIGO, but already, you know, people can use it to kind of attack these models and see if there's anything else going on out there. So
absolutely. You know, it'll be interesting to see what the LIGO results can tell us about that and what we might be able to infer about that. And maybe it might help us get a little bit closer to an actual theory of quantum gravity. Again, More data is always better because we have a lot of interesting theories of quantum gravity, like string theory and stuff like that. But a lot of these theories don't have any experimental verification. And LIGO gives us an opening to some additional ways of doing experimental verification of some of these theories. And so I think that's something that's interesting.
And of course, as you've already said, as you've already guaranteed, in fact, LIGO will be winning the Nobel Prize.
Yes, I won't guarantee this year, but I'll guarantee that it happens.
Until they win the Nobel Prize, they can make do with number one on Ian Durham's list.
Yes.
Of physics breakthroughs of 2016, which is almost as good.
Almost as good, yes. I should make little, like, medals, medallions, and hand them.
Well, I guess that's it for this year, but we've given people some homework to do.
Yes, we have.
We've got them to go away and find out about what higher dimensional sphere packing has to do with error correcting. And then I think you've also set them the practical task of building their own version of the LIGO experiment in their basement, just to prove to themselves how hard it is to do.
It's not very hard. If you have a partially silvered mirror and a laser, which, you know, a lot of people have, just, you don't need an expensive laser, just a little, you know, you buy it at the store or something like that. You could get a little bit of a pattern. You could at least see what it's like to do an experiment like this.
Well, there you go. We've given people tasks to work on for the next year.
We have.
Wonderful choices. Thank you very much again, Ian Durham, for taking the time to, you know, spend your year looking out for these breakthroughs, noting them down, and then sharing them with us at the end of the year.
Well, thank you for having me, as usual.
So there you have it. Packing higher dimensional spheres, discovering a nearby exoplanet, and beating the Rayleigh limit all made the list. But first place, of course, went to the discovery of gravitational waves by the LIGO collaboration, as announced in February. More about all of these advances can be found on the podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast. That's all we have time for this year. As usual, you can contact us by email at podcast@fqxi.org or on Twitter @fqxi. All that remains is for me to thank Ian Durham once more and to wish you all a happy new year from FQXI. I've been Zia Morali.